Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you, Rep. Michael and Senator Yarborough, for being here with us today. We're, I think we've done this a couple years now and helped to make it an annual tradition to just touch base with you guys going into the legislative session. And I want to start with, I think you know probably most of us, but we'll go around the table and introduce ourselves and then give yourself an opportunity to introduce themselves too. So you know me, Chris Hoffman, Mayor Jacksonville Beach.
Dan Jansen, Mayor Pro Tem, Jacksonville Beach.
John Wagner, City Council, District 1, which is kind of our core business district.
Ashley Gossett, CFO here at the City.
Mike Stefopoulos, City Manager.
Hi, David Niggett, City Attorney.
Bruce Wilder, Councilman at Large.
Bill Horn, District 2, south end of the beach, and I will also preempt my comments with, if for any reason I have to leave early, it's not the company, it's afterwards, not at Mayo, so right, depending on the time.
And Sandy Golding, District 3, which is the north district of Jackson Beach.
And then up here
in the south,
want to introduce
himself? I'm Pat Grigsbury, legislative for Secretary.
And today was his first day.
Lots of questions for you.
Lots of answers. Paul Donaldson, also with Senator Yarborough.
I'm Destiny Davis, legislative representative Michael.
Okay, we have our planning director, Heather Ireland, here, and our city clerk, Molly Alger, is also with us.
And our
communications director, Jacob Bohr.
So
we will first give an opportunity. If you guys want to give us an update on kind of going into the session, not to put you on the spot, you know we're pretty informal here in Jacksonville Beach. You should try to go to all the meetings in Jacksonville Beach, by the way, as soon as you can. So just give us, you know, kind of what you're looking at going into the session, anything that might in particular.
I want to add that Greg Sutton is on council also, but he wasn't able to make it.
He's traveling.
Give
us a preview of what you guys are looking at.
Thank you. Sure. No, and thank you all for the venue again. I was thanking the mayor for that. We appreciate you very much for letting us come and have this, you know, time before we get into the throes of more committee weeks and session, which starts January 13th, I believe, coming up. So it was a shorter summer for us this year, but that's kind of the nature of the odd year. And then when we go into the even years with the elections, it's a little longer. We think, we don't know. It was a 105-day session this year. It was supposed to be 60. Yeah. It turned into 105. But no, I think, and I know the rep will speak to it too, the House is already rolling out some property tax proposals, which I know is top of mind for everybody on those. So I won't steal the thunder on that. But that's probably going to be one of the big things. And then just in general, there's a health initiative that the governor has mentioned that he's adamant about as far as how that may affect the schools and vaccines, some of those things, medical freedom, if you will. So some of that's still in the hopper, but nothing has come out specifically on that just yet. And then members will have various priorities, various budget items that that they push, that we'll push. Obviously, we're always happy to help our friends in Jack's Beach with those, like we've done before. So a lot of it's not known just yet, but I think there'll probably be a lot of discussion over there on many fronts, because not only for the two presiding officers, the Speaker and the President, but the Governor, it's his last, you know, going into his last year as well. So we hope it'll be smooth. We pray it'll be smooth. And, you know, hopefully we can avoid some of what happened before. We don't know yet, but hopefully, and we're just happy to serve and want to know your priorities, obviously, too, so we can push those when we're in those conversations. So,
Thank you.
I think that we have committee week returning, I believe, November 5th, maybe?
First
week of November. So I haven't been back yet. Had to take care of a knee problem. So that'll be my first time back in for a committee week. And I'm looking forward to that, because it kind of gives us an idea of what we're going to be dealing with and what's going to be the hot topics. I think going into the session, for us in the House at least, it kind of gives us an idea. And I would say that I do have some of the some information on the tax proposals. There's been several different proposals to handle the taxing issues as far as housing by several different members.
This is a simplified.
Okay. And so I'll have, Destiny will have these with the different proposals. I don't know if you all have seen these. are not, and this is just something that's been released from the house, and I think we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 different proposals that are out there. And so, and these are not set in stone, because I still have not heard what the governor's proposals will. What the governor's proposals will be. I know that we've heard him all say that he's in favor of just eliminating homeowners taxes altogether, because he believes once you buy, you own your home, there's no sense of continuing paying taxes on something that you own. For me, I'm still looking at bills and putting my finger on what I'm going to carry. And of course, with you all, with Jacksonville Beach, once again, we are going adamantly against for any money appropriations that you all need, because we feel it when we don't get that across the finish line. But I know the Senator and I work very closely together, and we're in constant contact. We talk to Sandy constantly, and trying to make sure we get what is needed for Jacksonville Beach, for each beach, but particularly we're here for Jacksonville Beach. So that is all that I have for now. I'm ready to hear what you have to say and what you all want to tell us, and y'all have always been very gracious and nice. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, again, we appreciate being here. Obviously, the property tax issue is a really big one. For us, and probably what we're going to focus on at this meeting. We are very active with the Florida League of Cities, and most of our members sit on one of the policy committees. I think we have all of the policy committees covered. So even more so than just our insight as the city of Jacksonville Beach, we can give insight on some of those priority issues as well. But we want to focus on property tax, because we know you're going in and you're going to be looking at a slew of bills. We want you to see us as a resource on what I feel very strongly, and I think my colleagues would agree, is a real shining example of how city government can work properly. And we're going to show you what comes in, how we're spending it, and just give you just really a primer on how we operate in terms of the property tax, so that when you do have questions and you are in the nitty-gritty of those bills, come back to us. We want to be that resource to you as well, because we're a debt-free city, we're lean and mean. I think we operate very well. I know not every city can say that. We feel very confident in saying that. So we're going to start off, and I would say, and to my colleagues and to you all and your staff as well, but this can be an informal conversation. We do have a slide deck to present, but stop. Let's talk and have conversations as things come up that you might want to dig into a little bit more, and if we need to follow up with any information after this meeting, we will. So I'll turn it over to our city manager, who is going to work with our CFO for this presentation.
Thank you, Mayor. And again, thank you both for joining us this evening. As the mayor indicated, number one on our list is the issue of property taxes, especially when we saw all eight proposals. We were like, ooh, yikes, that could have a real impact to us. One of the things we wanted to walk you through tonight is talk a little bit about our millage rate, our budget, our general fund, and both our revenues and expenditures that come in and out of the general fund, which is where all of those property taxes go into. So we've taken a presentation that we used at the time of our budget adoption, and we've made some modifications to it that we'd like to walk through with you this evening, just so that you can get an idea of, as the mayor indicated, how we operate and what we see as some of the issues. One of the things that I will point out, as she indicated, with having staffing on each of the policy committees for Florida League of Cities, at our briefing last week, we did have an opportunity to take a look at what were some of the top issues off of each of those policy committees. And there are a handful of issues that continue to pop up year after year. And we know it's probably a matter of time before something happens with one of those issues. So the homestead ad valorem tax is obviously a big one that's on the radar, because this is an initiative that the governor has been talking about. The House has just released 8 proposals, and we know that's going to be a very big focal point for both the House and the Senate this year during the legislative session. The second one, which has been, I think, about 3 years running now, is with regard to utility transfers. And any community that has a utility has the option, they don't all have to do it, but they have an option of whether or not they transfer any revenues from their utility into their general government operating, which in our case is our general fund. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because Jacksonville Beach does do a transfer to the general fund from our utilities. And there have been efforts over the last several years to either restrict or eliminate that transfer altogether. The third is local business tax receipts. It is something that has had provisions put on it over the last decade or so, but that's another one that every so often comes up with. There needs to be either further restrictions or elimination of the business tax receipts that are collected by local governments. And while that's a small dollar amount, again, it still affects our general fund. And the fourth one is sovereign immunity limits. That is one that I'm sure both of you are probably tired of seeing the numbers all over the board. We'll talk a little bit about that. But it's not lost on us that the first bill has already been filed with regards to that, to take the limits from 200, 300 up to 500,000, 1 million, with another escalator a few years out to go to 600,000 and 1.2. So we're going to talk about those four, and as we get to the end of our presentation, we're going to talk a little bit about it from the perspective of the cumulative impact. Because one of the things I think we've all garnered is that a lot of people who sponsor bills in Tallahassee look at it from a bill-specific perspective, but they don't necessarily look at what happens if potentially multiple bills all come into play at the same time. And we want to make sure you have a clear understanding of the position we could be in if multitudes of these bills actually come to fruition and how that might affect local government, not just us, but others around the state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our CFO, Ashley Gossett. Ms. Gossett was one of the CFOs around the state that actually provided information to Representative Dean Black, who was on the Taxation Special Committee. She gave him a lot of background information about our organization. And if there's anything that you see through this presentation that you have questions, please holler and we'll stop and discuss it. And if there's anything at the end that you'd like more information on, we're more than happy to provide it to you. So with that, Ashley, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. So for our fiscal 2026 budget, we adopted a millage rate of 3.9947 mils. And our entity-wide, across all our citywide operations, we have a budget of $248 million. And our general fund is $33 million. So how we benchmark our millage rate against cities that have the similar scope of operations, breadth of operations, and also our neighbors. And so we have consistently been beneath the state average for millage rate, and we try and stay on the lower end altogether. This year, you know, there was a lot of conversation about the millage rate, so we prepared a 30-year chart of our millage rate. And as you can see, the philosophy at the City of Jacksonville Beach has always been to be steady. We have essentially kept a similar millage rate throughout the entire 30-year history. And as you can see there, also our neighbors with the county millage rate and the school board millage rate. This is a chart our citizens really appreciate when they get their property tax bill, understanding that the entire amount on the bill is not paid just to Jacksonville Beach, it's going to the other taxing authorities. And truly, the median single-family home in Jacksonville Beach this year is $322,000. And so that household will pay $5,191 in tax. 21.7 comes to Jacksonville Beach, which is $1,090 for all of our general fund governmental services.
We're the donor group to the City of Jacksonville.
Yes.
So across our organization, our budget was $248 million this year. Of that, 26% is the purchase of electricity for our Beaches Energy Utility. And then we have budgeted about $3.3 million in capital projects across all the different funds.
I do have a question of your homeowners that are here within this Beaches area. All of them are on Beaches Electric, not on
yes.
JDA?
Yes.
Correct. Beaches Energy Services territory covers Neptune Beach to the north, all of Jacksonville Beach, and to the south we actually go into Ponte Vedra all the way down into the Nocatee area. That is all part of Beaches Energy's service territory.
If you don't see us taking notes, it's because we have our
assistants. No problem.
We're totally engaged.
So as far as expenditures by fund, our total budget, our electric utility, Beaches Energy Services, makes up almost 41% of our total budget. And our general fund budget is $33 million, which is about 13.3% of our entity-wide budget. And the revenues that we derive for the entire operation, about 65% of our revenues are charges for services through our different utilities. And then our taxes, entity-wide, both ad valorem and communication service taxes, make up about 18% of our total revenues. And so in our general fund, we broke this chart out in terms of the revenue types and then the departments that our general fund pays for. It pays for all of our public safety, with the exception of we've got some officers that are in our downtown Cape redevelopment zone, but our dispatch is paid for out of the general fund, our ocean rescue, our streets divisions, all of our park functions are paid for out of the general fund. And then our fire services agreement is also from the general fund. So in our general fund, about 57% of the monies in the general fund are from ad valorem taxes. In our expenditures, you can see more than 50% are our police and fire, public safety services.
So if the all of the bills that have been proposed all state that you have to actually pay for your fire department, your police department, with no exceptions, you can't reduce the cost of that. So in theory, if we did this and we adhered to that, there could be no funds left for other things. Like the other items that the CFO covered.
And so as Mike stated previously, the four different kind of areas that we've got a close eye on, the elimination of homestead, utility transfers, business taxes, and sovereign immunity. So from a financial point of view, this information I actually just got yesterday from the property appraiser's office, and so Mike just saw it this morning. But this is something I watch closely because, you know, as a numbers nerd, this is very interesting to me. The just value of all the properties in Jacksonville Beach, that's the market value of all of them, $4.7 billion is homesteaded property, and $4.8 billion is non-homesteaded property. So almost 50-50 for homesteaded and non-homesteaded properties in the city. But then we back off the assessed value differentials, which is the cap from people that already have a homestead and may have had it for many years. And then we back off the actual exemptions, both homestead and other exemptions that they may qualify for. And then we get down to a total taxable value. And what you can see on this slide, on the left-hand side, those are our homesteaded properties. They're 51.2% of their value they're paying in taxes. So they're only paying tax on half of the real value of their property. Whereas our non-homesteaded properties, they're paying tax on 79% of the value of their property. So we start off equal, and then we've already got this kind of exemptions in place for our homesteaded property.
That's a great slide.
So for our citywide, the total taxes that the city will collect in both the general fund and the tax increment districts will be about $23.5 million. Of that, $9 million is going to come from homesteaded property, and $14 million is coming from non-homesteaded property. And then in our general fund, our homestead properties are going to provide almost $6.9 million worth of revenue, which is a 39.6% of our total general fund revenues comes from homesteaded property, or 39.6% of our ad valorem monies come from homesteaded properties, and 21% of our total general fund revenues is coming from homesteaded property. And then 31.7% of our total general fund revenues are coming from non-homesteaded properties. And then looking at the business receipts, we budgeted $328,000 this year for business tax receipts, and that makes up about 1% of our general fund. And then we have two utility transfers to the general fund, one from our electric utility and one from our natural gas utility. And that makes up about 11.6% of our general fund revenue. And our transfers are based on consumption. They're not like profit sharing or if we make money this year, we send it to the general fund. It's a formula based on the kilowatt hours sold in a year or the therm sold in a year. So it's been pretty static year over year.
Pardon me. Yeah. Ms. Gossett, just for my quick understanding, and you know, this is my first year on the council. So our expenditures are $248 million.
Yes.
And our revenues are like $25 million less than that.
Yes.
So if the homestead property, if that income were to go away, it would be basically $7 million.
Yes, we would lose $7 million in general fund revenue. So that would inhibit our ability to save for future projects. Since we don't have debt, we use pay-as-you-go. It would kind of limit the pace at which we could do projects or perhaps the volume of projects that we would be able to do.
Thank you.
Yeah, like this year where we did extra projects over the budget amount because we had it in savings. Mm-hmm. So we could catch up on some of that infrastructure stuff. We would not be able to do that anymore.
Yeah.
I just thought it was a bigger number than that. I didn't realize.
So for the insurance expenditures, our insurance premiums, the policies that would be affected by sovereign immunity changes, in fiscal 26, the cost of those policies are about $268,000. In 2024, we closed our year with accrued claims in an amount of $150,000. And then Mike's got the changes, the proposed legislative changes.
And one of the things that we don't know at this point in time is how much our insurance premiums would increase by based on a potential change in sovereign immunity limits. All we know is that our HR department, who manages that program for us, has said that our insurance carrier has said, if those limits go up, your premiums will go up and we can't price it for you until we know what those new numbers are. So out of that $268,000 for insurance premiums, about a third of that is paid for out of general fund. So we can anticipate that there would be an increase to general fund impact if the sovereign immunity limits go up, just on the insurance premiums alone. Obviously, for accrued claims and or settlements, those numbers could see increases as well, as we'd be settling for not necessarily less than $200,000, but potentially up to $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 or more. So those are some things that sit in the back of our mind as well.
So if you recall last year when we were in y'all's office, that so this used to be on my policy committee, now it's in Sandy's. And it's come back to the forefront year after year after year, and it manages to get staved off year after year. But our fear is that if it's not addressed somewhere along the line, I don't know if you remember us talking about it, but my, just me, Dan, not representing the city of Jackson Beach, my position on it was we need to come up with a reasonable amount because it hasn't been addressed since 2011 or 2015, something like that. So it's, you know, it's the elephant in the room. If we stick our heads in the sand and we don't do anything about it, then it, the damage could be severe, if not even worse, the 600 to 1.2 million. And if we had an agreeable number, just for the sake of this conversation, 400 and 600, and you tied it to the CPI, and that way it fluctuates with inflation. Then that's something that probably, you know, municipalities and districts, because districts are affected by this as well, would be able to survive or you know, manage within those numbers. So I think, although it's good to push back against it and say we don't want any changes at all, I don't know that that's reasonable. You know, so. But the other answer is we don't accept, you know, 1.2, and that's way too much. And just a few lawsuits and we'll be bankrupt.
And I can say the Four League of Cities is saying that they support, you know, reasonable reasonable increase to the sovereign immunity caps. So, you know, that's probably going to be one of our priorities. So everybody knows that something that it does need to change, but we want to make sure that it's reasonable. It's not something that's going to.
And I don't know how the claims bill process ties to that. You would know better than I would. But I would think that if we change those numbers to something reasonable, that might back off of that process a little bit. And I know that it can come up and it's based on claim by claim. But and I'm not saying that we should, you know, eliminate that completely, because there are times that our egregious things happen and they're entitled to a claims bill process.
Yeah, that's a valid point. I don't know if, and I'd have to look, but I don't know if the claims, and they're considered individually to your point, they can have a pretty significant local impact. I don't know if they fall under a limit because they're separately voted on and considered, and you know, and that. But that's a good point. I'd research that and see, because we've approved some that are pretty sizable sometimes.
Sure. So,
yeah.
I know I've seen some come through the house. So if it's something that we can take a look at and maybe get some feedback to you.
Yeah, that's a valid point.
Yeah, be willing to try.
So as I started this all off by saying, you know, we try to look at everything in the aggregate as opposed to bill specific. One of the things we tried to do was say, you know, if there was activity on all of these fronts, what would be the cumulative impact to the city of Jacksonville Beach? One of the things I would like to point out with regards to the utility transfers, as we haven't talked too much about that, some of the things we've seen in previous bills that have been filed is with regards to if you are providing services outside of your municipal boundaries, then you would be restricted or potentially eliminated from transferring funds into your general fund. The city of Jacksonville Beach, and the way we're broken up with Neptune to the north and St. John's County to the south, a little over 50% of our service territory is actually outside of the limits of Jacksonville Beach. But it's been that way going all the way back to the incorporation of Beaches Energy in the early 1900s, 1925 or somewhere around there. And this has been an arrangement where we're not charging them anything different than we charge our own residents. In other words, Neptune Beach, Jacksonville Beach, and Ponte Vedra are all charged the same rate. So we're scratching our heads as to what problem are we trying to solve by saying you can't transfer funds into your general fund. So, but the long and short of it is that it does have a real impact on our general fund budget, which all plays back to that pie chart, which we'll talk about again. So when you look at the total revenue of our general fund at $33 million, the homestead property tax, if option number one of the eight options was enacted, which is just an outright elimination of homesteaded property tax, that is a 20.8% reduction in our general fund. If the business tax receipt was also rescinded and said that goes away, that's another 1%, another $330,000 approximately. And if the utility transfers are taken off the table, that's another 11.6%. For a total of 33% of our general fund revenue that goes away. Which then brings us to our final two slides. This one basically shows what the millage adjustment would need to be to compensate for the loss of those particular revenue streams. For the homesteaded property, it would be an additional 2.56 mils to offset the business tax, is the smallest at 0.08. and about another 0.9 for the loss of the utility transfers. But overall, it would be a 3.5% mill increase on top of where we're already charging 3.99. So it's literally almost a doubling of our millage to compensate for the loss of the revenue that could happen if these bills were all to pass in their entirety.
And just, Mike, while we're on that, so the non-homesteaded properties, that's not just vacation homes or rentals, that's small businesses. I mean, it's other.
Yeah.
It's going to be a massive impact to, you know, not the renter, but the owner of that rental.
They'll pass it along in rents to their.
So there's going to be dramatic impacts across the board to our small businesses and to our renters if we have to do something like that.
And nobody is going to stand up with the governor, anybody at the state level says, I want to cut taxes. Nobody's going to be like, no, leave our taxes the way they are. We want taxes. Nobody's going to. But nothing's come out where they say, okay, we're gonna take this money and we're going to get rid of this, but then there's going to be a hole. And there's nothing been offered as to where the return is going to come. And unfortunately, then it can be left to either municipalities. Somebody's going to pay it. You know, if you're in a two-income household and suddenly one person stops earning, but your bills are X, somebody's either going to work two jobs or three jobs, or, you know, something's going to happen. So either services are going to get cut. There's going to be some real issues.
So it's almost the one-size-fits-all concept. I think part of the problem is, yes, there's fat in some city budgets.
Absolutely.
I would say, to the mayor's point, we're the shining beacon on the hill where we really don't have it. You know, being a debt-free city and as pay-as-you-go, I would encourage our CFO to come up here and take a look and see what we're doing and use this as a pattern for other cities. And to the point of the utility transfers, I think that was born out of an issue that happened in Gainesville and Alachua County. And their answer was, let's just change it at the state level, not realizing the overall impact, you know, again, how that affects all municipalities across the entire state, instead of addressing the problem. It's kind of like the CRAs, which is a my policy committee, because you have some bad actors paying for parades and things like that in South Florida. The answer isn't to throw the baby out with the bathwater. The answer is correct the people that are misusing the funds and keep CRAs in place like they are. So
I am on the Finance and Taxation Subcommittee. And it was interesting when we went around and discussed this last week as a group, there are many cities in that room that if number 1 to 11 passed, they would cease to operate. You know, they're more bedroom communities. They don't have a lot of business. They have a lot of residential. One of the cities outside of New Smyrna had a 79% residential. And so they're, you know, they were looking at it as real issues. And it's funny because some of the folks in the room were hypothesizing what might be a real driver of this. And is it really to take charge of, right, at a state level, to take charge of local level money? And it was hard for these folks to kind of get their heads around it because of the we run our city right, and it's not an overly impossible task for us to deal with. But some of these other ones really were, and really were, you know, we're not here today to defend all of them, but it was kind of perplexing to listen to some of these organizations in these communities and what's going to happen to them if something like that were to happen without a way to recover, because they can't recover like we can.
I did want to clarify, you mean 211 or 201?
And is the first one
201?
Oh, I thought it was 211.
201.
Oh, yep.
I just wanted to
thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay.
I'd like to ask our honorable guests, if I might, what do you all think is behind this utility transfer thing? Is it, someone suggested to me it was the large, like the new powers of the world, I think they are, trying to put the little guy out of business. Does that make any sense?
It makes sense. I haven't heard that so much as over the past few years. I think it's maybe born of the notion, not speaking for legislators who have filed those bills, but what it seemed to me in looking at them over the past few years as they've cropped up is that they say, well, if the utility wasn't having to make a transfer, like, I mean, JEA is an example too, because they make a very, very big transfer to the city of Jacksonville every year, then your utility rates would go down. So therefore, snip that, and then you can lower the rates for the customers for the utility, because it's a city-owned utility, so then you can lower their bills. That's what it seems like to me. I haven't heard any of them say, but I can't find anything else to the point that Councilman Jansen made. The GRU issue in Gainesville, that came up 2 or 3 years ago. I want to say that right before the bill ended up becoming that the state, I want to say maybe the governor, I mean, it might have gone directly to the governor, could then appoint members of that utility. They were having a mess over there between Alachua and the city of Gainesville. The county, similar thing to what we're talking about, where you've got folks outside the city limits who are paying in, but they live in Alachua County, perceivably don't get benefits, you know, that kind of thing. So it's all kind of part of that same conversation, though, and they run in and, you know, did something there. But and I don't think it was angled. I don't think it was angled though to the point you just made too, to anything going on in Northeast Florida. Same with CRAs.
Right.
We have several in Jacksonville, and you have them here too, in the city, and you'll have them out here. But to my knowledge, we've never had any issues.
And
I hear there's issues in South Florida, so that's why there was a bill to deal with all of them. But you know, we were going to get thrown out too with all of them. So thankfully, last year that bill didn't go anywhere. But anyway, long answer to the question, but I think it's that mentality of, well, we can snip that and then we can lower the rates for the customers.
So, but if they do that, doesn't it ultimately lead to higher rates? Because if there's no incentive for me to make an investment in a resource for our community, because it can't help us grow, and this is, you know, why people have invested in these smaller utilities, and then it allows us to manage and keep our rates low. If there's no incentive for us to have that utility, that extra effort, that huge investment that you saw that we have to do every year, it's a lot simpler to operate the city without it. Then those bigger energy companies would just come in and they'd gladly take this over, right? They'd take this big headache away from us in a heartbeat. And with that consolidation, then they're really left to just raise rates. And what we have seen in almost every major utility industry, including healthcare, is consolidation has only led to increased cost. Mm-hmm. There's no study of any industry where it's led to lower cost. And so if we allow this to happen and we remove competition, which is kind of the opposite of capitalism, we are setting ourselves up to in a place where we're going to have a few very powerful utility companies in the state. And that to me seems counterproductive.
And they, as everyone in the room can guess, you know, they do try to do that, which relates to your question too. And I haven't heard that or been made privy to that, but I do know that that is definitely something they probably want to try to do. And you know, thankfully, as again with the case of Jacksonville, with the case of you out here, you know, that hasn't happened. But you know, I wouldn't blame them for trying.
Right.
But it almost seems that the common theme the state level, whether it's short-term vacation rentals, utility transfers, pick your poison. So, the one-size-fits-all narrative doesn't work.
No, it just doesn't
work.
I agree.
And so now the question becomes, can you do carve-outs? And I know that's not always a favorable thing at the state level, carving out certain individuals, but maybe that's an answer if we have to address it. You know, like if a short-term vacation rental bill comes up, we'll say, okay, well, we'll just carve out Jack's Beach, you know, or if they want to make it worse than it already is, you know. Mm-hmm. Ideally, we'd like to swing that pendulum back to where we have a little bit more regulatory control here at Jack's Beach.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I know the ADUs is on the horizon too, so that's been talked about in our policy committee. So.
Well, and just one last thing on it too, tying the two together, that's a very valid point. And then also, it slipped my mind a minute ago, but to your point about the people out there, the folks we represent, they have, I believe, more of a voice when you have the local utility here, and even with JEA, even though it's a much bigger animal, because it's directly under the purview of the city, i.e. the elected officials.
Absolutely.
Versus then removed from that more where they, you can go to the PSC, but you know, then it's still removed and it gets lost in a lot of things. So I like that we, you know, may not always agree with folks that serve on, you know, all boards, but it's still directly accountable to the city, which is headed up by the people elect, you know, and all. So that's something that's good.
Yeah, if
it's good to be there.
Duke Energy decides to increase they were our vendor and they decided to increase our rates, there would be no discussion that anybody can attend, and then the discussion would be with the shareholders, and the shareholders would be like, absolutely, we're going to increase our rates. That's the
right
one, yeah. And that's where kind of the enterprise fund transfer. Look at JEA, with the Beaches Energy Service, you know, it is, you're the customer, but you're also the shareholder. And, you know, if I own Coca-Cola stock, I'm still going to drink Coca-Cola, and if I get a dividend, great. That dividend comes back to me. The Beaches Energy, the customers are getting that dividend in Jacksonville Beach. And one of the things that came up, you know, or the other issue that came up with extraterritorial surcharges, the concept of taxation without representation, and I don't know if you heard that, that was kind of the argument that, you know, of somebody out there paying more.
Right.
It's not taxation without representation. I want to make sure that you guys, you know, if you can echo this at Tallahassee, in Tallahassee, this is fee for service. If I mow yards in Jack's Beach, and it's $50 a yard, and you come to me and you say, hey, I want you to come mow my yard in Tallahassee, or mow, you know, the Capitol Lawn in Tallahassee, well, it's not going to be $50. Because that's going to be, the, you know, I have to go, that's a lot. There's cost associated with what we do. And for us, and that's the other thing, is we do not charge. We service, a lot of the growth that came out of Ponte Vedra, Nocti, and those areas was because we were willing to put in infrastructure. And so putting in infrastructure, being willing to do that, it's not like there are developers out there, because Florida's a huge state, there's a lot of empty dirt. But there are no developers that are just going out there putting in big subdivisions and going, God, I wish somebody would bring along some electricity and water. This would be great. No, you know, when we put that in, then the building comes. And that's, it's not, I've heard that before, and it's very frustrating, but it is not taxation, not representation. There is, they do have the option to reach out and speak to people. They may not have a vote, but it is not.
Well, we are the representation.
Exactly. Yeah. Correct. Yeah, we are the ones, and we're approachable. Everybody else, other entities are approachable as well.
Mike, do you have any more slides?
One more slide.
All right. Just dying to get through it, aren't you, Mike?
So just as a refresher, you know, the homestead property alone, if number one goes through 201, that'd be 21% reduction. If all of them go through, it would be 33% reduction. So then it brings us back to the pie chart, which shows where our expenditures are, and so we can look at things in the cumulative. Our police and fire and emergency services is 52% of our general fund expenditures. So if we're talking about coming up with a 33% reduction, that's coming from the other half of the pie, because all of the bills that have been proposed through the House all have a public safety hold harmless clause associated with them. And also 166.241 in Florida statutes, you can't do more than a 5% reduction of public safety, otherwise there's a call for an audit from the state. So assuming that you can't touch the left side of the pie, the police and the fire and EMS budget, then that means that the remaining 48%, 33% of that has to go away, or you have to find an additional revenue to fill that gap. And that is a portion of our public works, parks and recreation, planning and development, non-departmental expenditures, executive and finance. That's real impact to us, and we wanted to make sure that you all understood that this is coming from an organization that has a good mix in the community, 50-50 of assessed valuation of homestead versus non-homestead. We are a community that has no debt. We have a utility that's extraterritorial. This is an example of what the real world impact could be to us if multiples of these bills were to go into effect.
Basically,
Mike, could you explain what non-departmental, what covers?
I'll let our CFO cover that.
So primarily what we have in our non-departmental is our actually insurance costs. So it's the expenses in our non-departmental benefit all of our governmental activities. And so we didn't want to allocate insurance off to each of the departments. We also have our internal service charges are in the non-departmental. So the portion of the human resources that oversee all of these departments, that cost is billed to non-departmental.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but
Well, I did have a question. It was a few slides back and I should have stopped. When the number for your police,
we'll go back to it.
I think it's right there.
This one?
Yes.
Police expenditures of $13.6 million.
Now, that is that included? Do you all offer your police force retirement?
Mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. We do.
So that's included in that.
Yeah, our retirement contribution is in that number.
Yeah. Does that include the contribution from CRA?
No. On this screen, it's just the general fund. So that is the officers that are assigned to the general fund and their corresponding retirement contribution.
Yeah. Thank you.
As you guys would appreciate, part of what we have the opportunity to do is to be the playground for Jacksonville during weekends and great beach days and summer. So our police department is designed to be able to make sure that we can deal with that type of onslaught on a somewhat regular basis.
But that means we have to pay more than other cities our size, because we they do have to have a larger police force, and they have to have more capabilities to deal with some of the things that they deal with. So that number is probably higher for us than it would be for another community.
And there's,
that's not
the idea of a sleepy little beach town. This is not a sleepy little beach town. It is the playground for the other, 950,000 people that are just on the other side of the intercoastal, and everybody comes here. And of course, as a lot of people know, when people go on quote unquote vacation, I'm going to go out for the day, I'm going to get crazy, and then they come out here and be silly, and our police department has to deal with it.
And our chief will tell you that over 80%, 87% of the arrests in Jack's Beach do not live in Jack's Beach.
They live in Jackson.
I think it's also worth noting, and thank you for bringing up the pensions, because we do have a defined benefit plan that is very well funded. So unlike some other cities, especially that really struggled for a while, we have in well into the 80s.
87%,
our police and general funded police. So we've done a very good job maintaining that and making sure that those funds are there for our retirees.
Right, and I think it would be even higher, but we had an onslaught of retirees that just left in the past year or so. So. But even at that rate, still fantastic.
Yeah, that's really good.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but, and Mike might know the answer as well, isn't there a state statute that limits the increase in the millage rate as well? Like, you can only raise it 3% in a year.
It's capped.
Yeah.
There's 3 over 3 years?
Something to that.
It's 3 a year.
I think it's 3 a year.
The homestead of property, and I think it's 10 for 9.
So it was... Right, right.
That's for the assessment.
Which ends up being another problem for us, another unintended consequence.
One of these proposes to change that, too.
Yeah.
To make it 3 or 3 and 15 all over for the homestead.
That's
That's a really bad, too.
Now, I think with all of these proposals, what the speaker has told us is that he's asked us to do exactly what you all, what we're doing right now. You all are ahead of us, I think. Which is to have the conversations with our communities, with our districts, and let you all know so you can see. So you all are on it because you already knew about these, but there are a lot of communities that are not, and municipalities, to just have these conversations, get an idea of where you are, what you're thinking, what we're looking at, how it will impact you, how any of these will affect you, because it's not really at the end of the day our decision. We're here to represent you all. This is something he's talking about being on the ballot for the voters to vote on. So, which I think is the right thing, so that the voters have a voice. Yeah. But our concern and our, I know I don't want to speak for you, is a priority for me to hear this. I need to hear everything that you all are saying. Because, like you talked about the carve-out, looking at a potential carve-out. The way the carve-outs work in the House, I don't know if it's the same over there in the library.
They're so pleasant and beautiful. I said, oh, my gosh. Because it is wild.
So it's more like a library.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. In the House, it's a different, it's a
carve-out.
Different monster
the house altogether.
It is a carve-out. So everybody's screaming, hollering. We're all trying to get ours, and we're just kind of indicative of our personalities. I think, you're kind of like the calm guy, and
I used to be part of the carnival.
And then I'm kind of like, no.
I don't get the party life anymore. But if I could piggyback on that a little bit, and I think, and we know too, in working through these, we have to decide which ones the voters ultimately decide. We know we have to try to fight for the right ones, or the right mix, or however it's going to be. Right. These are start points, but we know we need to support the right one to be in front of the voters too, and balance everything out.
Right.
So we've had conversations about that too. So.
It's hard to believe that that we're not going to be able to get a majority of voters to eliminate one of their biggest taxes. And so I think we ought to go into this with the understanding or the expectation that whatever you put on the ballot will be accepted. There's a, if you look at just the socioeconomic distribution of our state, because this isn't now a certain market area, it's a state view, because it's going to go vote for the state. And you look at the fact that we are so heavily on senior population. So I have an 87-year-old mom, lives in the same house for 30 years. I've explained to her, and by the way, highly educated, ex-school principal, got dual master's degrees. And when I explained to her why the elimination totally of property tax would negatively impact her quality of life and the quality of life in the community that she lives in, we would no longer be the community we are. The people that live here come here because we have our events. They come here because we are a safe environment. We have a great police department. A lot of that stuff kind of neutralizes, and all communities are going to be somewhat similar in what they can provide. And she still says, yes, but I'm on a limited income, and if I'm given the opportunity, I'm voting for it. So if you think about the distribution of seniors, lower income, and we're not talking low income, but you know, mid-income down, it's hard to believe all those folks aren't going to vote for whatever's on there. And I want, by the way, I want lower taxes, so don't, I'm not saying I don't, but if 201 ends up on there, it's going to fundamentally change the local landscape of municipalities in this state. And so we just need to really make sure that as we work through that, and I'm hoping it doesn't, I have some that I want on there. And the Florida League of Cities has said, we're not going to come at this and say no to everything. We want good, positive recommendations being made as well. And so Florida League of Cities is going to propose actually some different ways we might reduce property taxes in a way that more of the municipalities can support. But it does. It is scary because everybody looks at 201 and says, oh, my whole property tax goes away. Why wouldn't I vote for that?
Well, the unintended consequences might be necessity is the mother of invention. Sales tax all of a sudden starts taking hikes up, you know, or mm-hmm. wouldn't be a vote by me because I'm conservative. But when the push comes to shove and you start affecting your police services, which we had to deal with that in the past year and a half, we said, all right, we've got to do something. We got to keep our community safe. So now what happens? We can't touch the property tax because it doesn't exist, or there's a version of it that you can't touch. So again, necessity becomes the mother of invention. They're going to find ways to create income so that we can have public safety and fire safety and the essential services for our communities.
Well, like we're talking about too, not to mention the impact on business too, if more of that load is put on them, and then what's that going to do is they think cost of operating, cost of doing business, and all. I was going to ask if you, and it doesn't have to be limited to the ones that are on the paper, but just to the group, what, you know, if it's some other version or iteration too, where do you think that more common ground or sensible spot, if that's the right way to say it, would maybe it could be based on these or based on another idea that we may not have in front of us yet. Because we're still on the first end, the front end of the conversation. So, and if not now, it's okay. If anybody has other ideas.
We're probably not at that point in this room, but I think that the League of Cities would kind of follow their lead. But I will say we recognize that there's many machinations of these bills that are going to go on between, you know, in the next couple of months. And so I think the key thing is that we want you to see us as a resource on what those impacts are going to be and the unintended consequences, you know, if we say no, but we need to replace it with something else, what that else is, how does that impact? I can just say, if we increase sales tax somewhere, then that's just increasing consumer prices.
Right.
And that's going to hurt small businesses too. So there's always going to be, you know, you pull one lever and there's going to be an impact. So I think there's a lot of that. And once you go to the voters, it's going to be a lot harder to change it again, so you kind of one bite at the apple with that too. So so I think this is, you know, again, we just really wanted to show you what we're doing and give you a little bit of that higher level view of our city and how we operate so that you could see how in reality this is going to impact the city in your district. So I don't think, unless anybody has their solutions, probably not the time to start brainstorming that.
Not as a brainstorm, but just based on a series of conversations and being able to spend a fair bit of time over last week with folks representing a bunch of different cities, the couple of concepts or themes that were kind of prevalent, so I won't say like here's a baked solution, but to make it apply to like some form of means testing. So you'll hear a lot of people say like this should apply to all seniors. Well, there's a lot of rich seniors. And so I don't think that's the intent to get, you know, people that have a value over X to get a tax break, right? you know, that's not who's being hurt. And so both means testing as it relates to seniors and means testing as it relates to non-seniors, you know, the fear is if it goes too deep and it goes into a sales tax, then the people who get most punished are the most needy, the most fragile in our community, because they're also consumers. They're generally not property owners. So what we don't want to do is shift the tax burden of the rich to the poor, because that to me seems the opposite of those that much have been given, much is expected. And so that's kind of one of those themes, was how do you means test it to a component, and then make sure that you layer in a kind of a fairness quotient, particularly as we talk about people who've owned their homes, paid for their homes, you know, and I think we've heard, you know, the governor talk about this as well, but not everybody who's in that situation is of need.
And well, so, the fortunate thing is for them, is for you, the means is set by Jacksonville Beach. We are the example of what government should look like. And when you take a city like ours, and I'm sure there's other cities throughout the state that you're familiar with that are debt-free or close to debt-free and are fiscally sound, use them as the example to say, hey, listen, you know, this 201 is not just going to kill those who are way above the millage rate level of the state, but it's also going to hurt those who are playing by the rules, so to speak. So,
and you've got, you know, and there are a lot of things that are supposedly going to come up. You know, whether it's the property tax, if you add in, okay, no property tax, we're going to cut out the homestead exemption. Well, then we're also going to cut out the enterprise fund transfers. Okay, well, then there's another chunk. And we're also going to cut out extraterritorial surcharge, the possibility for, you know, there's, well, that one's a little different. But bottom line is if you add all these things together, it's just it's shot after shot after shot into the heart of how that municipality city operates and where they get their funding, and it's going to cause us problems.
At some point, it gets really hard to fix.
$1.2 billion lawsuits, right?
Sovereign immunity.
Yeah, we just were finishing up a 900-day infrastructure project of sewer and water, where we had to replace it because it's, you know, aged to that point. You know, those are the types of things that really get at risk when we go past kind of taking the fat out of the system. And so that those are the things that are really kind of scary, because, you know, replacing that infrastructure is, I mean, that's important to all of us in our homes.
So just in the interest of protecting everyone's time and being courteous to you about you all and your schedules, do you have any other questions as we kind of wrap up?
I'll look forward to getting emails with any ideas that you have, because really I'm not happy. I'm not enthused about any of them personally that I see before me. And so you know that. So I would like to have some more information, some more input, some ideas. I am not, I'm in favor of carve-outs, of fighting for carve-outs, because it literally is a fight. That's where I was going with the circus.
You got distracted by
the
heat.
You know, it's something you have to, you really have to fight to have a carve-out for your particular district, municipality, that you recommend. I'm not afraid of the fight. I'll fight all day long. And I will do that, I think. Senator Yarbrough is much more nicer with this fight. At the end of the day, I think we always tend
sometimes
to get it. Yes. Sometimes you are. You kind of, you know, and I'm like, yeah, I'm So that's what I would like to definitely hear from you all and get some information, some input, some ideas.
Absolutely.
Because this is going to be something. This is going to be interesting.
Would we be able to share this presentation with both of them so that they've got...
Absolutely. I was going to ask that, if you are okay with it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That would be great.
Sorry,
I didn't mean to interrupt. If we can get
we'll
your contacts
too,
in the back. I think we already have yours, Destiny.
The association and or league, you know, we're putting out there and all, and they're very faithful to come to us, and I'm sure they'll be giving us the stuff too. And, if y'all think of anything, let us know.
Please forgive me. I want to be respectful of your time, and I really appreciate you all coming here and giving us this opportunity. And Ms. Michael, as you may or may not recall, I reached out to your office months ago about short-term rentals, and somewhere I heard or read that the governor is amenable to increasing revenues from these short-term vacation rentals to compensate. Is there, I spent a lot of time looking at around different cities to see what they were doing, how they were regulating their short-term vacation rentals where they were allowed. But this idea occurred to me, and I don't know, as I've been trying to craft an ordinance that you would carry, because you had mentioned at some point you would be amenable to that. Mm-hmm. But obviously we need, do you have any ideas on, I had written this down during our last briefing, how we could get more money from the revenues that these short-term rentals are generating? Because just on my street alone, I have at least 5 just on my block, and 10 within like 300 feet of me. And the one across the street from me rents for $1,400 a night. So there's this tremendous revenue that I think we're barely even scratching the surface on. Would you have any idea how I could put something together, or would you guys even want to try for something like that? I don't know, I want to speak for you.
I remember your email. I remember, as we talked about this, we had a pretty lengthy discussion because I was looking for it. I remember you talked about you sending that in. And I've actually been having dialogue with someone from the governor's office on what can we do, because what his response is and where is he standing, and we're still in dialogue about that. But I know it's needed, just don't know what the answer is. I don't know how do we get to. So what you're basically saying is to have some type of a, I don't want to say cap or some type of a structure when it comes to the short-term rentals, and so that we're following the same thing, so that we're at least making money, so that it's beneficial without it being abused.
Short-term vacation rentals are currently regulated much like hotels, and there's a 7%, I think 7% state, 6.5% local that they pay. 7% state, 6.5% local. So if we were to, unfortunately, those lobbies are huge right now, and it would be very difficult to push one on just short-term vacation rentals and not on the hotels, the hotel industry, because again, that's what it's modeled after. That's where the taxes are right now, and that's at 13.5%. If it were to go up, if it were to go up precipitously, unfortunately, I think some of those short-term vacation rentals would go away, and then we would lose that 13.5%. I do see the concept has come up, like, hey, we're a tourist state, and yes, the hotels, we could, find another percent or two somewhere in there, 2% local, 1% state, 1%, 1.5% each, that would, be pushed off on the majority of our tourist clientele. I know, obviously, I travel in the state, and I've stayed, nobody's going to notice 1.5%, I don't think. A little there, and I would have to look. We'd have to see the numbers and see what that would do. My thoughts.
Senator Yarbrough, I'd be curious on your thoughts.
I'd be open to looking at it. I'd need to dig in and see how that structure works now. You've enlightened us some on it, and that's helpful too, what you brought up too, Councilman. I'd want to look at that and see, and open to consider it, but would want to test those numbers and see what it looks like.
All right, well, thank you.
Yes.
I would think that the position of the city of Jacksonville Beach at large would not be an effort to raise revenue from short-term vacation rentals, per se. I know that was Mr. Waters' premise of his question. For us, we would like more local control in general, and I think that that's the key. And do I have enough nodding heads to say that that's our consensus? So the local control capacities, zoning districts that they're allowed in, things like that, because as you both probably know, we have a real issue here spread throughout our neighborhoods, all over Jacksonville Beach, none in Neptune, none legally operating in Neptune and Atlantic, because they banned them before 2011. So right now we kind of feel like we're on defense. We haven't seen anything coming down the pike this session yet, but we're on defense with that. But if there's an opportunity to go on offense and bring some of that control, because there's nothing more local than who's living next door to you. And when that is changing every single weekend, that's a problem. And we are hearing it, and it's still very painful here in Jacksonville Beach for our citizens. So it's not about revenue for us. Obviously, we need to compensate for the, we are paying more for the tracking systems and things like that, and staff time, and you know, the fire marshal and the planning department that are all involved in these. But I think more importantly to us would be that local control and being able to regulate them locally here in our community. And I don't think anybody's interested in an outright ban, but we do need to be able to say you can't have, you know, how many can advertise, the enforcement to be able to stop them, the bad actors, from operating, things like that. So there's an opportunity for that if you see a window where that might be something we can get in. It may not be a League of City top priority at this point, because obviously the sales or the property tax issue is, you know, taking up all the air in the room, but that's something we would be very interested in.
That might be something, just if I could, Mayor, that might be something to ask them. I'm not a good, quick, innovative mind, you know, it helps me to have a template to start with, just in full disclosure, but so sometimes that's advice in the legislative branch. But what I was going to say is maybe the group, you know, maybe the county group could look at some model piece of legislation or something like that that can be put out there, and the initiative can be taken to, you know, to do that. And that's the first I've thought of it when you mentioned that. We're usually running defense when these bills get filed over there, and we're trying to do what we can to, you know, say no and bring all this up. But if there was something like that that could be,
right, it's not
at least
a,
the idea put out.
Right, it's not an ask of complete removal of preemption. Right. It's just give us a slither of the pie back, you know, so that we can have a little bit more.
So just a thought. I mean, and I know we're coming up quick on this year, but maybe something in the wings there.
Actually, I think we have something draft coming from Erin.
Our lobbyist said that she had something from a prior.
Erin took a look. She found very limited information.
Okay. Well, that's something we can certainly start working on.
Yes. I think we'll work on that as well as start working on a possible carve-out if we need it.
Okay.
Just have it ready for me, because I think that, that helps if you're on top of it.
Yeah.
Because then I can sell it to the other representative, or the, whoever the representative is of whichever bill I'm trying to say no on, that I'm saying no on. Can you call us out? And when I, you know, you do that when you recognize that there's not enough of us to fight with me against this bill. But definitely, if you can put that together, and just have it ready,
just in case,
out on the press, in case you can get it right to us. And I'll share it with your office.
Thank you.
Any final comments?
Right, I'm sure you will.
Final comments?
Really appreciate
go ahead
the
and wrap it up. We very much appreciate
you. Thank you.
Thank you for representing us. That's thankless drive up and down I-10 a couple of times a year.
We
appreciate your time this evening. And we will see you in Tallahassee on January 27th.
Well, we get there the 26th, but I think our meetings will be the 27th.
Yeah, it's going to be early.
This week three,
cold.
Yeah, we don't like that. It's probably going to be cold and dreary, but we'll bring some jackets.
Y'all bring some sunshine.
We will bring the sun.
Thank you all.
But we will for sure bring your calendars and pop in.
Thank you all.
Thank you, Senator.
Yep. Thank you.